Hi, this is Bruce Lipton, and you're listening to Green Planet FM.
Kia ora, greetings, and welcome to Green Planet FM 104.6. I'm Tim Lynch, and I trust that you are doing well. I invite you to stay with me over the next hour as we discuss and find ways to take care of our unique and magnificent green planet Earth. Today, Lisa Eyre is standing in for me, and her program is sponsored by The Awareness Party, a movement for social transformation at www.theawarenessparty.com.
Kia ora, I'm Lisa Eyre, standing in for Tim Lynch on Green Planet FM. In February, I interviewed Dr. Paul Connett from the USA, who was visiting New Zealand and lecturing about the damaging effects of fluoride on the human body. If that surprises you, just think, fluoride may be good for the teeth, but if it affects the teeth, then logically it affects all the other parts of the body. Since Hamilton City Council decided to stop the adding of fluoride to the town's water supply, there has been much outcry and debate about fluoride, and after a referendum, fluoride is now to be put back into Hamilton's water. What sort of information did the people of Hamilton have when they voted to put fluoride back in the water? They believe that fluoride is good for the teeth because they have been told it is, not because they have looked at independent research, I'm sure. They have been brainwashed by the toothpaste industry, who assured us that fluoride in our toothpaste will stop cavities. And indeed, applying fluoride topically may not be as inappropriate as adding fluoride to the water. But then we have the dentists and health professionals who are covering themselves against any professional or legal issues if they're found to be wrong about adding fluoride to the water. So self-interest is a huge reason around the push for fluoride from the dental and health departments. Why isn't the Ministry of Health funding research so that New Zealand citizens don't have to second-guess the facts when all the facts are not presented to them? Even Harvard University says that the studies done in China on the effect of fluoride on children's IQs should be looked into more, yet good old New Zealand is still willing to risk the dumbing down of our population in order to save a small bit of tooth surface. When Dr. Paul Connett was in New Zealand, he challenged health professional to publicly debate him on the issue, and no one stood up and did so. They know that they are just promoting an official line and do not actually have all the facts, some of which have not even been researched yet. Yes, we're guinea pigs for the health industry and the agricultural industry and all the industries that invade our bodies with chemicals that we cannot avoid. So on to my interview with Professor Connett, which I'm sure you will find fascinating. Welcome, Paul. I am just so thrilled to have you here working in New Zealand, assisting us in getting fluoride out of our water.
It's great to be back, Lisa.
Well, you know, I'll just read a little bit from your book, The Case Against Fluoride, just as an introduction for people who might think, what's she talking about? Fluoride's good for our teeth. But first, when the fluoridation of drinking water began, there was little evidence for its long-term safety. And since then, little attempt has been made to monitor its health effects systematically. And a little aside from Lisa there, that's the same issue as we have with genetic engineering. Now, because there are so many unanswered health questions, fluoridation of water must be considered an ongoing experimental procedure. And as such, it's a violation of the Nuremberg Code, which forbids experimentation on humans without their informed consent. Only a minority of countries practice fluoridation. In Europe, nearly all countries either have neither fluoridated their water or have ceased doing so. Yet the incidence of caries has declined just as much in those countries as in countries that practice fluoridation. So there are definitely major question marks, and Dr. Connett, over the last few years, has become a real expert in finding out just what some of those problems are. So, welcome, Paul.
Thank you, Lisa. Thank you.
Would you like to tell us How did you get into this in the beginning?
Well, you have to blame my wife. July the 6th, 1996, I was busy doing some work at home, and she brought a bunch of papers and put them on my table, gave me a cup of tea. I should have been suspicious. And I said, "What's that?" And she said, "Fluoridation." So I said, "Take that away. Those people are crazy." And anyway, she persuaded me to read these papers because that evening our village council was going to revisit this issue. We'd been fluoridated for many years. My wife was not aware of it. I wasn't aware of it. And she wanted to find out whether we were going to tell the council that night whether to continue or to stop. Anyway, as I said, I did not want the issue. I was thoroughly busy teaching chemistry full-time at university and also working on waste. Waste management over the last 28 years has taken me to 49 states in the United States and 60 different countries. So this, my weekends and holidays were all mortgaged to these two issues. I didn't want a third issue. And especially, I didn't want a third issue that would stigmatize me as Looney Tunes, Dr. Strangelove in the United States.
Yes, because you're Professor Emeritus, aren't you?
Yeah, I've retired now since those days. I retired in May of 2006. Anyway, I started to read these papers, and I was shocked and I was embarrassed. Embarrassed that I'd gone along with this brainwashing, essentially, that people who oppose to fluoridation are crazy. Very self-serving if you promote a practice to have the other side labeled as crazy. In fact, I found out that the first opponents of fluoridation in the United States were, in fact, biochemists. Biochemists that had used fluoride to poison enzymes in their experiments. Anyway, the two things that struck me when I read this material was, one, that whilst fluoride, from a chemist's point of view, is fairly benign, it's not like fluorine, the parent element, which is incredibly reactive, most reactive element in the periodic table. Fluoride is what it becomes after it's reacted. It's fairly benign. It's like comparing common salt with chlorine. You know, chlorine kills people, but salt we sprinkle on our potatoes. And so my view of sodium fluoride would have been in the same, that fluorine is bad, but fluoride is okay. Well, anyway, the first thing then was that it's very active biologically. It interferes with enzymes. It interferes with metal ions that we need for things. It carries metal ions that we don't need into places they shouldn't go. It interferes with G proteins, and there's so many things. Anyway, the second thing I found out was that the level in mother's milk. Remember what mother's milk is?
I remember you telling me last time that a bottle-fed baby gets 200 times more fluoride than a breastfed baby.
That's
in
right.
New Zealand.
That's right. The average level in New Zealand in fluoridation is 0.85 parts per million. And the level in mother's milk is 0.004 parts per million. So as you're right, it's about 200 times more. And how many parents in New Zealand, in Auckland, for example, how many know that they are giving their baby so much more fluoride than a breastfed baby? I think very few people. And there are some organizations now, medical organizations, that are recommending that a baby gets no fluoride until at least the age of six months. And okay, so that told me something. When I saw how low it was, I said, you know, who do I believe here? A bunch of dentists in Chicago, the American Dental Association, or Mother Nature? Who knows more about what the baby needs? I would put my money every time on nature. That, A, it indicates to me that the baby does not need fluoride, and it also indicates the possibility, likely possibility, that the baby is going to be harmed by fluoride. And that's actually the conclusion reached by Arvid Carlsson, who was a Nobel Prize, is now a Nobel Prize winner. He led the successful fight against fluoridation in Sweden in the 70s. And he said in 1978, one wonders what fluoride with a bottle-fed baby, wonders what that fluoride is going to do to the developing brain of the baby. Now, there's one thing that they all knew when fluoridation was begun in 1945. They knew it was going to be a trade-off. They knew it was going to be a trade-off between what they hoped was lowering of tooth decay and a condition called dental fluorosis. This is a mottling discoloration of the tooth enamel. But they thought that they could hold the prevalence of this to about 10% of the kids. And it's several levels of severity, dental fluorosis, and they thought they could hold it at the very mild level. And they thought that only dentists would be able to recognize that, not ordinary folks. Well, run the clock forward, and now in America, 41% of American children aged 12 to 15 have some form of dental fluorosis. 8.6% have the mild form, which impacts 50% of the enamel. And 3.6% have between either moderate or severe, which affects 100% of the enamel. But be that as it may, so we can argue about the relative impact, what that means.
Well, it must make some wonderful work for dentists.
Oh, it does. They are earning more money today treating dental fluorosis than treating tooth decay, and certainly the tooth decay they would have to treat if there was no fluoride in the water. We can argue about the significance of the dental fluorosis to a teenager, for example. Some will not smile. Some will not try to open their mouths on dates when they have certainly the moderate condition. We can argue about that. But the real gamble that they took was that you could damage the growing tooth cells in the baby's body without damaging any other growing tissues, like the bone, even though the teeth grow out of the bone, like the brain cells, like the endocrine system, and all the other delicate tissues of a newborn baby. And people that are cautious say, wow, that was a real gamble that they took in 1945. And even worse, when in 1950, and you alluded to this at the beginning with your quote there, in 1950, when the U.S. government endorsed fluoridation, not one single trial had been completed. So they hadn't proof that it was effective. And secondly, the number of health studies that had been published were practically zero. So it was a huge gamble to go ahead with fluoridation in those, and clearly political, because it wasn't scientific.
And Paul, I'd really like you to tell the listeners where our fluoride comes from.
Yes, it's people probably will not believe this, dentists do not believe this, but I will assure you this is absolutely true. It comes from the scrubbing liquor of the wet scrubbers in the phosphate fertilizer industry. For many, many years, phosphate fertilizer industry contaminated the local environment with two gases, hydrogen fluoride and silicon tetrafluoride. And let me backtrack. To make phosphate fertilizer, you take phosphate rock, which is not soluble in water, and mix it with sulfuric acid, and that makes soluble phosphate, phosphoric acid. But in this process, you drive off these two very toxic gases, plus a lot of other contaminants. And for about 100 years, this was decimating the local vegetation, the citrus crops in Florida, crippling cattle as the cattle ate the grass and so on. And eventually, they had to put a spray of water, and that spray of water converts these toxic gases into a solution called hexafluorosilicic acid. And here we run into ironies, because they can't dump that stuff into the sea by international law, and they can't dump it locally because it's too darn concentrated. It would cost them an arm and a leg to get rid of it as a hazardous waste. But one of the vagaries of hazardous waste laws, at least in the United States, is if someone buys a hazardous waste from you, it becomes a product, and it's no longer regulated by hazardous waste regulations. And that's what's happening. The public utilities are buying this stuff, making it into a product, and then putting it into drinking water. And that sounds bizarre, but that's exactly what's happening.
What happened here in Auckland is we had a mayor, Mayor Robbie, years ago, and he was against putting fluoride in the water. But the pressure was on him so strongly that he was prepared to put food-grade fluoride into the water. So that's how fluoridation started in Auckland, I believe. Mm-hmm. But then, of course, soon it changed and it became industrial fluoride. So what's the difference between food grade and industrial? Because I think most dentists would probably make the assumption that we're actually getting food grade fluoride.
No, we're not. We're not getting pharmaceutical grade or food grade. What the problem here is that this stuff is contaminated. And it's amongst one of the substances that is arsenic. Now, arsenic is a known human carcinogen, which at least from our regulatory authorities is no safe level. You're going to have an increase in cancer if you're exposed to any arsenic. So inevitably, by using industrial-grade fluoride compounds instead of pharmaceutical grades, you are going to increase the cancer rates in your country. That is regardless of whether fluoride itself causes cancer, and it may well do. There's one extremely well-done study from Harvard University that shows that if young boys are exposed to fluoridated water in their 6th, 7th, or 8th years, they have a 5 to 7-fold, i.e. 500 to 700% increased risk of succumbing to osteosarcoma, which is a rare but frequently fatal bone cancer. So actually, we might be killing a few people each year. But I remember interviewing John Cahoon in 1998 in this country, in Auckland, and John said, how many teeth would you have to save to justify the death of just one child from osteosarcoma? That's a lot of teeth in my mind to put in one scale pan. If in the other scale pan, you're going to lose your child at 18 or 19. John Cahoon is one of my heroes. I mean, I have never been more impressed by someone's integrity. Remember, John Cahoon was the principal dental officer of Auckland and promoted fluoridation very effectively, both as the dental officer and as a counselor. And he remembered with chagrin that he would insult opponents, make fun of opponents of fluoridation. But as a reward, the authorities here sent him on a world tour in 1980 to collect the data from around the world to prove once and for all that fluoridation was effective. And he went to Australia, he went to Asia, he went to North America, and he went to Europe. And to his utter dismay, the people behind the scenes were saying, John, we're not finding a difference in tooth decay between fluoridated communities and non-fluoridated communities. And when he came back to New Zealand, crestfallen, there was a report on his desk marked confidential, and it was the tooth data for the whole of New Zealand for children. Because unlike other countries, you actually measure tooth decay in all your kids, not just surveys, but every child gets analyzed. And he found there was no difference in the tooth decay between the fluoridated cities and the non-fluoridated cities in New Zealand. If anything, the tooth decay was slightly better in the non-fluoridated communities. And John had the integrity to go from an avid promoter to equally avid attempt to stop fluoridation.
We need more people like him.
Yeah. Very impressive.
That's wonderful. Yes.
We have a few others like that. Dr. David Kennedy in California went through a similar change. Dr. Bill Osmondson, a dentist in Oregon and practices in Oregon and Washington State. Dr. Hardy Lineback, probably the most famous. Hardy Lineback was head of preventive dentistry at the University of Toronto. He was former president of the Canadian Association for Dental Research and a practicing dentist. Again, he was the spokesman for the Canadian Dental Association for fluoridation. Read the literature very carefully and changed his mind and actually apologized to his students for promoting fluoridation.
And I remember when you did your last presentation 2 years ago that you said Japan has decreasing tooth decay and they don't fluoridate.
It's not just Japan. It's all over the world. I mean, the World Health Organization tracks tooth decay in 12-year-olds in umpteen different countries. And we have the data from the 1960s to the present. And if you plot that data by country, and the data for each country is tooth decay in 12-year-olds. And if you look at that, in every single country, tooth decay has been coming down as fast in non-fluoridated countries as fluoridated countries. And the tooth decay now in the 2000s is a wash. You can't tell the difference whether it's a fluoridated country or non-fluoridated country. For example, New Zealand actually has an average figure a little bit above some of the European countries. 97% of the European countries do not fluoridate their water. And if you ask them why, they say, number one, we do not think that all the health issues have been resolved, and they're absolutely correct on that, because the science is lousy. They're, in New Zealand and Australia, Ireland, the other fluoridated countries, you're not doing any health studies. You're flying absolutely blind. You're not tracking how much exposure people are getting to fluoride. There's no measure of fluoride in the urine, in the blood, in the bones. You're not tracking that. You're not looking at health effects. And even when these health effects are being found in other countries which have high natural levels, India, China, parts of Africa and so on, you are not even attempting to reproduce those studies in these fluoridating countries, including New Zealand. And I'll come back in a moment and talk about the IQ studies, because we now have 36 studies which indicating a lowering of IQ associated with fairly modest exposure to fluoride, which should... That would, you know, if this was a rational world, that would prevent you using fluoride as an additive to motor oil, let alone an additive to the drinking water of every man, woman, and child in your society.
Well, it's mass medication, isn't it?
Absolutely.
And it's given without our permission.
It's worse than that, Lisa. It's a lousy medical practice. Any doctor that supports fluoridation should be ashamed of themselves. Let me explain. We have never used the public water supply to deliver any other medicine since fluoridation began in 1945. For obvious reasons, once you put a medicine in the drinking water, you can't control the dose. I mean, that's a no-no right there. You've got to be able to control the dose of any medicine. Secondly, you can't control who gets it. It's going to go to everybody. Once you put it in the water, it's going to go to babies. It's going to go to sick people. It's going to go to people with poor nutrition. It's going to go to elderly people. It's going to go to people with poor kidney function who can't get rid of the fluoride. It's going to go to people with borderline iodine deficiency who are particularly susceptible to fluoride's toxicity as far as the thyroid gland is concerned. So it goes to everybody. Ask a pharmacist if there's any drug that they deal with that can go to anybody and in any dose, and they're going to take it for the rest of their lives. I mean, he's going to look at you as if you're absolutely stupid. Okay. The third thing is what you're alluding to. When you put a medicine in the drinking water, you're getting mass medication. You are violating the individual's right to informed consent to medication. Now, I don't know about the New Zealand Medical Association, but the American Medical Association is very precise on their webpage about what informed consent to medication means. It means that you have to, as a doctor, you have to tell the patient what the drug is for, what it's good for. You've got to tell them what the side effects might be, what the risks involved are. And then the patient is left to make the decision themselves whether they're going to take this drug into their body. And if a doctor tried to force a patient to have that medicine, they could lose their license.
At the moment, I buy spring water so that I can avoid using fluoridated water. But it would be better that those that actually believe in fluoride and want to take it were given fluoride tablets. It would probably even cost the country less.
Oh, it would definitely cost less. Definitely cost less. And yes, look at the different imposition here. If you live in a fluoridated community and you want to avoid it, not only have you got to have buy spring water or bottled water or get reverse osmosis equipment or something in your house, very expensive. Even that doesn't protect you when you go downtown and have a cup of coffee, a cup of tea. When you go to work, you're still getting fluoridated water. When you go to a friend's house, you're getting fluoridated water and the food and the water. It's very difficult to avoid it once a community is daft enough to put it into the total water supply. Now, I do have a compromise here. I do have a compromise. Supposing at the end of this discussion, and it's very difficult to get a discussion with the promoters, they like a solo platform, and I'm prepared to debate them, and we will see after 3 weeks whether there's anybody in New Zealand, whether it's a doctor, dentist, or a public health official who has the courage of his or her convictions, who proudly tells the people that fluoridation is safe and effective, safe and effective, safe and effective, the most wonderful thing we've ever done in public health, if any of these people can defend that position on a public platform when I'm there, do you want to take a bet on it?
Well, I don't think it's likely, but I would like to say to listeners, if you know anybody that could take Dr. Paul Connett up on that offer, please contact me, Lisa, through my website, www.theawarenessparty.com, and you will find me on there. In fact, you'll find Dr. Paul Connett's talk on Friday advertised on there, but I'll mention that again at the end of the program.
Now, I think this is outrageous, by the way, if they don't debate this. This is their policy. It's not our policy. It's their policy. They are doing something to us. They're putting this known toxic substance into our drinking water. We are forced to drink it. And don't say we're not forced to drink it. If you're on a low income, you are forced to drink it because you can't afford these avoidance measures. So this is something that they're doing to us. They have a position that this is safe and effective, so on, so on, so on. When we challenge them to debate, they refuse to debate it. They refuse to defend their position in public. I've never heard anything so outrageous in my life. Look, if they cannot defend this against all comers, including myself, that is a clear signal that one side has the science and the other side hasn't. We actually do have the science. The science says that fluoridation is not effective. If fluoride works at all, it works topically, not systemically. The evidence is there. You can't tell a difference between children who've grown up in a fluoridated community or a non-fluoridated community. The evidence that they suggest that it's working in New Zealand is pathetic. They cite four studies. Two of them show no difference between tooth decay in the community they looked at, the fluoridated versus the non-fluoridated. I think the other two shows a saving of maybe half a tooth surface out of 128 tooth surfaces in a child's mouth. So the science says it's not effective, it's not working, and the science now says that there are dangers, serious dangers like lowering of IQ.
Well, there's no safe level established, is there, for this? And I think about, you know, living near Auckland, and our lettuces are probably grown out in Pukekohe, and there's fluoridated water there. So we're not just getting the amount that we drink in a few cups of tea. Sports people are drinking large numbers. We've already talked about babies. And even though I'm avoiding fluoride, when I go out for dinner and I have lettuce or vegetables that have been grown, they've had fluoridated water put on them, even the ones from my own garden.
Yep, and particularly beverages, beer, soft drinks are made in communities which are fluoridated. You're going to get this dose of fluoride. So the proof is there. As I said, they thought only 10% of the kids would have dental fluorosis. Now we have 41% of kids between 12 and 15 in the States. I think you have over 25% here in New Zealand, but you're like every other health studies, you're not doing very good studies here in New Zealand. And it's not that you're different. This is, if you're a fluoridated country, it appears that the government is more interested in protecting this policy, protecting its reputation, its credibility, than it is in protecting the health of the people. And that has to stop. I mean, fluoridation, there are a lot of health issues out there, a lot of environmental issues, like your genetic engineering is probably the single most important issue facing us today. I mean, the arrogance of manipulating genes and then distributing them willy-nilly all over the place on our breakfast table everywhere is absolutely repugnant to me. And being led by a company, Monsanto, that poisoned the world with PCBs and dioxins, I wouldn't trust them to cross the road safely. But anyway, to come back to this issue of fluoridation, it's one of the easiest issues to end. It just takes a strong wrist. You have to go to the public water works and you take the spigot and turn it off. But to turn it off, you need political will. And to get that political will, you need masses of people educated and organized. This radio station is doing a great job contributing to the education of thousands of people in New Zealand. But that's not enough. Those thousands of people in New Zealand have got to educate their friends, educate their neighbors, and start to get organized. You know, have a coffee meeting on a Saturday morning. Go to our webpage, fluoridealert.org. Go to Fans New Zealand's webpage. There's a wealth of information that you can share in the form of DVDs and books and everything else. We, as I said, we have the science, but that science doesn't go anywhere unless people are listening and whether they're organized. And once they're organized, then we got to put pressure on the politicians. This is a ridiculous practice. It should never have started. And now that it's gone on all this time, it's about time it came to a stop. One way it could come to a stop is if doctors did their job. Instead of letting this, their colleagues at the Rotary Club, their dental friends, run the show, and with all due respect to dentists, they know a lot about teeth, but they do not have qualifications or expertise to talk about the rest of the body. So when a dentist tells you it's safe, he's gone way beyond his professional expertise. It's his opinion that it's safe. That's fine. We all are entitled to our opinion. But unless you can base that on a solid scientific studies, it doesn't mean very much. But doctors could intervene and say, this is a violation of the informed consent to medication, of individuals' right to informed consent to medication. We are allowing whole communities, whole cities, to do to everyone what a doctor can do to no one. That's crazy. I mean, if you've got regulations governing what a doctor can do, how come a whole council can violate that? No, it's unacceptable. We need doctors to speak up. The hottest places in hell are reserved for those who, in times of great moral crisis, choose to sit on the fence. I think it was Edmund Burke who said that. Evil triumphs when enough good people do nothing.
Yes, yes, he did. So I'm interested in, you're talking about doctors. Tell me about thyroid. What does fluoride, or how is it affecting the thyroid?
Well, it does, but we don't know the mechanisms. We know that doctors in the 1930s, 40s, and 50s, in Argentina, France, and Germany at least, were giving patients with hyperthyroidism, overactive thyroid gland, fluoride tablets to lower the thyroid function, to lower it. And people like myself have said, well, if you're lowering the activity of someone with a hyperthyroid, what would you do if you treated someone with a normal thyroid? Wouldn't you get make somebody hypothyroid? And what about someone who is already borderline hypothyroid? Are you going to make their condition worse? Well, we have literally an epidemic of hypothyroidism today in fluoridated countries.
Yes, myself included. Yeah. And so I think it's extremely common. Actually, you can even look around at people and say, oh, yes, I can see why they've got a weight problem. That's you can look at the face and the neck, and you can say, yes, that's their thyroid. So I'm sure that this was not so common years ago.
Yeah, and this is probably why people with borderline iodine deficiency are very, very vulnerable to fluoride's toxicity. If you look at the levels which have an effect on people, if those people also have borderline iodine deficiency, the effect of fluoride is much worse. They found that in one of the Chinese studies. They found a lowering of IQ at 0.88 parts per million when there was a borderline iodine deficiency as well. So it made it worse. So you could say the IQ is at this level with borderline iodine deficiency. You throw in our fluoride as well, and the fluoride was lowered still further.
This is Lisa Eyre for Green Planet FM, and I'm interviewing Professor Paul Connett, who's been brought to New Zealand by the Fluoride Action Network. That's www.fannz.org.nz. Professor Paul Connett is speaking on the problems associated with fluoridation of our water. Professor Connett is going to be speaking in Auckland this Friday, February the 22nd, at 7:30 p.m. in the Hillsborough Room at the Fickling Centre, 546 Mount Albert Road, Three Kings. So you can hear Professor Connett in person this Friday. So the lowering of the IQ through fluoride, and of course, fluoride was used in concentration camps, wasn't it?
No.
No? Is that incorrect information?
I just resent it. Please, Lisa, do not. Do me a favor. Don't say that again in public, because we have them on the ropes as far as science is concerned. Fluoridation is not effective. We can demonstrate that. Fluoridation has huge risk with no adequate margin of safety. But damage to bones, damage to brains is occurring at levels which means that some people are going to be impacted drinking fluoridated water. They're on the ropes scientifically. But if we start talking about conspiracy or using fluoride to dumb down the people or limiting the world's population, number one, we offend decent people that believe in this. I mean, it's a belief system. Many, many dentists believe in fluoridation. It's all they were taught at dental school, number one. They think they're doing good. They're proud of what they're doing. And the trouble is that they don't have enough time to read the literature. But if you start saying that, talking about Hitler using the concentration camps, then they take offense, and rightly so. They're not mass murderers. They're not out to hurt people. And it's offensive. My wife and I did actually check in to see whether or not the single source of this information, whether it panned out, whether there was good evidence. There wasn't. We contacted the Wiesenthal Foundation, you know, the group that tracks down Nazi criminals. If anybody would know about this, they would have done. They couldn't find any evidence. Also remember that the Nazis were incredible about documenting everything that they did. They were proud of their wretched human experiments. They were proud to be able to convert human skin into lampshades. And so they documented it all. And if they would been able to simply control a population simply by sprinkling a little bit of sodium fluoride in their water, they would have been put it down. They would have recorded this stuff. So I don't think it's going to help us to spread the story around. And it could lose people.
No, well, that's very interesting, because that's something that's been said for a long time.
Oh,
yeah,
people repeat it all the time ad nauseum, and it hurts us. You see, the other side is saying all the time they have two strategies to convince people that fluoridation is good. One strategy is to endorsements. They will recite these long lists of organizations that endorse fluoridation. It's not science, of course. Many of these organizations have never researched the issue. There's practically none of them have researched it recently. Most of the endorsements actually go back to when the U.S. government endorsed it in 1950, which was the green light for the row of dominoes to fall over. And you can see that in our book. Chapters 9 and 10 talk about that event when the U.S. government endorsed fluoridation in 1950. Within a year or two, all those professional bodies had endorsed fluoridation, still without any trials complete, still without any significant health data published. So, but that's one strategy, endorsements. Oh, if all these wonderful organizations think it's good, who am I to disagree? Number one. And the other one is that the people opposed to fluoridation are a bunch of crazies, conspiracy theorists. So when you come up with a conspiracy theory like the Nazis using it, then that confirms to those decision makers, those local councillors. No one wants to be embarrassed, okay? If you're a councillor, you're a decision maker, you don't want to be embarrassed. And that's they like to do this. So when a council or let me give you an example. Peter Vallone Jr. is the councilman for New York City, and he came out and introduced a bill to remove fluoride from New York City, which would be extremely significant if it happened. And he got about a dozen or so councillors to agree with him, but not enough for a majority. But the moment he came out against it, there was the article planted in the local newspaper that Peter Vallone Jr. had put the tin foil hat on and just absolutely ridiculed this fellow for having the temerity to suggest this. So it's a ploy. It's a ploy. It's a strategy. It's a PR strategy. Number one, your side has authority. Number two, the other side is a bunch of Looney Tunes. And then our ploy is to say, if it's as good as you say it is, come out and debate it. Prove it on a public platform. Prove that your science is more solid than our science. And they can't do it, and that's why they won't debate.
Now, the New Zealand government's science that they use, I believe, is the York Report.
Mm-hmm.
And the York Report, I noticed on the Fluoride Action Network website, you have done a critique of that.
Well, I was an invited peer reviewer of the York Review. And there were some good things about the York Review. They did a good job with dental fluorosis. They admitted about 48% of kids in a fluoridated area worldwide have dental fluorosis. They admitted that the quality of the studies were very poor, and it was difficult to make any judgment on both effectiveness and safety. For the effectiveness, they actually could only find six studies, longitudinal studies, not cross-sectional studies. Longitudinal means comparing tooth decay before and after you've fluoridated. Cross-sectional is comparing fluoridation in the same moment in time across countries, across communities. They could only find six studies. They only find six studies, and over a period of about 60 years. And these studies range from a 5% better performance in the non-fluoridated than the fluoridated, down to a 60% reduction. But percentages are very, very confusing or deceiving, and I'll explain that in a moment. But what they did was to take these six studies with a changing baseline over 60 years, made an average, and said it's a 15% reduction. And this is minuscule, in effect. In the United States, we had the largest survey ever done. They said 18% difference if between children who lived all their lives in a fluoridated community and children who lived all their lives in a non-fluoridated community. This is a massive study. 39,000 children, 84 communities. 18% difference. If you look at what that 18% was, it was a saving of 0.6 of one tooth surface out of 128 tooth surfaces in a child's mouth. So you're looking at small differences between small numbers, and it's impressive to get the percentage. But as I say, impressive, 18%. Other people have been claiming 40, 50, and 60%. So the actual saving, what people need to find out in any of the studies that they report, what is the absolute saving? How much tooth decay in terms of tooth surfaces in the mouth is being saved when they talk about their percentages? And it's trivial. I mean, would you really risk a child's life with dying of osteosarcoma so that you can get an average saving of 0.6 of a tooth surface? And in other studies in Australia, the saving is less. In two states, it was between 0.12 and 0.3 of a tooth surface. And in New Zealand, you have a couple of studies, again, about half a tooth surface. So the savings are negligible.
And fluoride actually only affects, for those savings, only affects children when they're developing their second teeth. So all the rest of us don't need it. Is that correct?
That's right. As far as any systemic effect is concerned, that's only for children. The systemic effect is going to be before your teeth have erupted, so that's absolutely no significance whatsoever for adults. But they actually concede, and this is why we're not finding any difference in tooth decay today between fluoridated and non-fluoridated countries, is because it works topically. Works at the outside of the teeth, not from inside the body. When the Center for Disease Control conceded that point in 1999, it should have been the end of fluoridation, because if fluoride works topically, then we have fluoridated toothpaste, which you can brush on your teeth, direct it straight to the target organ, and then spit it out. This way you avoid exposing all the rest of the tissues in the body, and also you avoid exposing people that don't want it. So you solve both the medical problems and the ethical problems by advocating a different delivery system, even if you believe in fluoride, namely brush it on your teeth and spit it out.
And I remember vividly you saying one day that, you know, having fluoride in your water is like drinking your suntan lotion.
That's right. I mean, once you know that something works topically and that organ is available topically, then why on earth swallow it? It just doesn't make sense. It really is so illogical. And unfortunately, I think that fluoridation is such a preposterous practice on every conceivable level. Both on efficiency, practicality, ethics, and risks involved, the riskiness of it. It's so preposterous that when listeners listen to someone like myself talk about it, they've got two choices. One, I'm crazy, or the government is doing something absolutely stupid. And they would rather, but some people would rather believe it's this guest of yours who has a British accent, etc. I mean, we can imagine all kinds of things about who Paul Connett is. But they would rather believe, possibly, it's easier for them to believe that I'm the crazy one, and their government is highly respectable, very intelligent, and doing the right thing.
I don't think there's too many people or too many of our listeners who would actually think that government is doing the right thing. However, I will say one thing for them, and that is that they didn't recently put folic acid in the bread because of the mass medication issue, because it was really only for pregnant mothers that they were going to do it. So they have looked at that argument and decided that mass medication isn't the way to go. So there's no consistency between that decision and the decision to put fluoride in the water.
Yeah, absolutely. And especially, too, it's even more so with water, because you can avoid certain breads. You can make sure that you buy the right bread or whatever. You can certainly have some freedom of choice there. But once it's in the water, you really don't have any freedom of choice. And it's not being able to control the dose that makes this such a bad practice, and not being able to control who gets it. If at the end of the day the other side convinced you or convinced everybody that drinking fluoridated water actually reduced tooth decay, if they did that, the way to do it is to make up liter bottles of fluoridated water and make them freely available, pharmacies, supermarkets, dental clinics, health clinics, or whatever. This way you could use pharmaceutical grade fluoride. Two, you could control the dose, because you would say only drink 1 liter of this a day, or the rest of the water that you use the tap. Thirdly, you wouldn't be forcing it on people that didn't want it. And fourthly, and really importantly, people that bottle feed their babies would not be forced to use fluoridated tap water and expose those babies, their developing brains, when the blood-brain barrier is not fully formed, to fluoride. Even the other side is worried about the dental fluorosis. So they are recommending, the American Dental Association in 2006 actually recommended parents not use fluoridated tap water to make up baby formula. But they very quickly realize what they were doing, and that if it became clear to the public that fluoridated water was not safe for babies, then people would really question whether fluoridation was a good idea at all.
And I remember when you stayed at my house 2 years ago, you talked about that little bit of fluoride left in the bottom of the kettle of the fluoridated water, because when you boil water, I believe it concentrates the fluoride.
Yes, it does. So some people ask you, they say, well, would it help to boil the water, fluoridated water? And the answer is no, it actually makes it worse, because when you boil the water comes off as steam. So if you like, over time, less and less water means that the remaining solution there will be more and more concentrated in the fluoride. In other words, the fluoride does not come off in the steam when you boil the water, it's left in the water. So in that kettle of yours, as it goes through all these cycles, each time you boil that kettle, and if you leave some water behind, that keeps on getting boiled, and therefore it's going to, the residue is going to get more and more concentrated. So watch out.
So that's the first thing that you can do to control your fluoride intake, is to empty your kettle fully each time before you boil it. Yeah. And of course then health food shops sell natural water. I'm not so sure that the ones in the supermarkets are. in the bottles, so such a good idea. So, Paul, just let's go over some of the health concerns that you have for fluoride. Let's just to sort of start rounding up.
Yeah, I have always been concerned since 1996, which was about the time, 1995 was when the first animal study was published in the United States. Phyllis Mullenix showed that that rats exposed before birth were hyperactive. Rats exposed after birth were hyperactive to fluoride, a study for which she got fired. they said to her, she was the chairman of the toxicology department at Forsyth Dental Center. In fact, the first chairman of the first toxicology department in the country in a dental school, she was fired and told that her work was no longer relevant for dentistry, meaning it's no longer relevant for protecting the fluoridation program. But anyway, that was 1995. I got involved in 1996, and at this time was when the first IQ studies came through from China showing that children exposed to fairly modest amounts of fluoride had lowered IQ. Now there have been 36 of these studies, and when I say modest levels, I do mean it. One study that I'm particularly interested in, because I actually went to the Chinese villages where the study was done, and I know it was a good study. The authors controlled for lead and iodine, which would have been important co-founders because they both interfere with IQ development if you have too little iodine or too much lead. And Zhang, the author, estimates that the lowering of IQ, the threshold, was 1.9 parts per million. Well, that's what I mean. You don't have an adequate margin of safety to protect everybody, every child in New Zealand. Because think about it, you can't control how much those kids are drinking. So a kid in New Zealand that drank 2 liters of water at one part per million fluoride is going to be getting more fluoride than a child in that Chinese study that was drinking 1 liter at 1.9 parts per million. So there will be an overlap in dosage, in dose, between a community at one part per million and a community at 1.9 parts per million. Secondly, whenever we have a small study showing harm, you take the lowest level that you find to cause harm and divide by 10 to get a level which you can be confident will protect all the children or all the people in your society, which takes into account the full range of sensitivity, because we don't all react the same way to a toxic substance. Some of us are going to be resistant, some of us are going to be particularly sensitive, and most of us are going to have an average response. So the typical safety factor that we apply is to divide by 10. Let me do a crude calculation. Let's assume that the kids in the Chinese study and the kids in New Zealand drank about the same amounts of water. Okay? That's a crude assumption. In which case, divide 1.9 parts per million by 10, and the safe level to protect all your children will be 0.19 parts per million. In other words, right now, on average, your kids are getting 4 times more fluoride that you would want, because you're fluoridating at average in New Zealand 0.85 parts per million. 0.19 is what we would deem to be safe based upon that Chinese study. We have had another study which is very important. This was 2011 by Ding and co-workers, and they used a different methodology. Most of these studies, the 36, compared a high fluoride village with a low fluoride village. And not so high, but 9 of the studies, for example, were less than 3 parts per million. In this study, they just took children who were drinking water between 0.3 and 3 parts per million. And what they measured was IQ and the level of fluoride in the urine. So really they had a handle on individual exposure to fluoride, because the more you drink, the more ends up in the urine. And they found a very strong correlation between the lowering of IQ in those children and the amount of fluoride in their urine. So a strong correlation between how much fluoride these children were exposed to and lowering of IQ. And over this range of between 0.3 and 3 parts per million. Now, anybody in toxicology that looks at a study like that has to say this practice is no longer tenable. It has to stop. But it's always interested me. In fact, my first environmental health issue was lead. Back in the 1970s, I was very concerned about lead. And in the 70s, it was very, very clear that the children exposed to lead could get brain damage. And it was clear that this happened at high levels. So at high levels of lead exposure, you get irreversible brain damage in a child. And what some scientists were arguing in the middle 1970s was, well, you know, if a high dose of lead can actually cause irreversible brain damage, what about levels of lead preclinical? In other words, when a parent can't even see a problem, but they're still being exposed to low levels of lead. There's not a problem that gets the parent to take them to a clinic or a hospital. There's something wrong with my kid. Could that be affecting the brain development? And eventually, in 1979, Herbert Needleman demonstrated once and for all that very low levels of lead were interfering with the child's mental development. And I think that what we're going to find in the not too distant future, and I think we're finding it already, that the fluoride is just the same as lead. There really is no safe level for exposure, and it's just simply a function of how well we design our experiments to see how the fluoride is affecting subtle mechanisms in the brain. We have over 100 animal experiments now, which shows that fluoride can enter the brain, concentrate in different parts of the brain, interfere with different processes in the brain, all well established. Many of them, of course, as with animal studies, are done at high doses, but there's one in particular which is a very low dose. They gave rats, Varner and co-workers, gave rats one part per million fluoride. They had three groups of rats. They had the control, had another group of rats that were given one part per million fluoride as aluminium fluoride. Another group was given fluoride at one part per million as sodium fluoride.
Which is what we have.
Yep. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure how many communities use sodium fluoride, but most of them today use hexafluorosilicic acid or its sodium salt. Anyway, what they found after 1 year of feeding these rats one part per million fluoride, they developed kidney damage, brain damage, visible under microscope, and an increased uptake of aluminium into the brain and beta amyloid deposits, which are characteristic of Alzheimer's disease. If you look at the total weight of evidence, it's overwhelming that there's something wrong here. Fluoride and the brain. As I said, over 100 animal experiments, 10 animal experiments which shows that fluoride-exposed animals had behavioral changes, 36 studies which shows that lowered IQ in humans associated with fairly modest exposure, 4 fetal studies where they've looked at the brains of aborted fetuses in high fluoride areas in China and found changes in the brain, and several human studies which have found behavioral differences between fluoride-exposed and non-fluoride-exposed. If you take all of that and apply weight of evidence, clearly we have a problem here. And in fact, I would say today that despite the concerns about methodologies from studies from China and etc., the quality of the studies which are demonstrating a harm are far superior now than the studies that ought to show that fluoridation actually reduces tooth decay.
So it's our challenge to get the changes that we want to see around fluoride throughout New Zealand. So there's your challenge, folks. And Dr. Paul Connett spends much of his time travelling the world assisting with this issue. I would like to really thank you, Paul, for all your work and for coming to New Zealand and for coming on the show today. Thank you very much indeed.
Can I give a little postscript?
May.
Okay. I like to say, trying to put the perspective of experts like myself into perspective, it goes something like this. Affecting change is like driving a nail through a piece of wood. The expert can sharpen the nail, but he or she cannot push that nail through the piece of wood. You need the hammer of public opinion to drive that nail home. So I hopefully have sharpened a few nails of people listening to this program. I can't stop fluoridation. They can.
Wonderful. Thank you very much, Paul.
Thank you.
Thank you for tuning into this Green Planet radio show. I trust you have derived both enjoyment and insight as we empower ourselves with a greater understanding of the magnificent, multifaceted world that we inhabit. In these coming times of rapid change, it's going to take raw courage and inner resolve. And so I thank you as we all remain both focused yet relaxed as we challenge the status quo and let go of the old as we energetically co-create the new paradigm.